it was funny just even to have Bill go, what's with this lesson? This is a really uncomfortable lesson. It's fun to be able to teach the women about this. Tonight, as I teach the men, it'll be a little bit more difficult. We'll see how that goes.
We'll be praying for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Since I have neighbors and young marrieds and my mm-hmm. own husband. So let's pray and begin. Father, thank you so much for your Spirit's teaching of us. Thank you that you share how you work in the patriarchs and their sons. Thank you, Lord, that you remind us over and over again that you do the same with us, that you are so consistently working in our lives. Father, I pray that we won't miss it. I pray that today, as we dive into a very strange lesson, that you would give us insight into how it relates to our own lives and the way you work in our own lives. Father, may we be in awe, not just today, but as we walk through the week, at how much you give us and how much you intend to make us into the same glory that was in your Son. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so as we begin here, we're looking at chapter 38. And as some of you even mentioned at the beginning of, as we're talking about this, it seems like chapter 38 interrupts the flow of Joseph's story. One of the reasons is because we think it's Joseph's story rather than it being the sons of Jacob's story, right? It's the family story. But of course it does focus now on Judah, which is a little strange, it seems. But it is connected to the end of 37, because at 37, that last verse says, meanwhile. And so it's saying, meanwhile, Joseph is in Egypt and Judah is in Canaan. What's happening to the family in Canaan at the same time as what's happening to Joseph in Egypt? So the meanwhile connects the stories. It says, it's like, I mean, we watch films like this all the time. We read stories like this all the time, right? We want to know what's going on here in Chicago while at the same time what's going on in Kansas City, right? So we don't have the ability to do two dimensions at one time, so you tell one story first and then the other. So Judah's story is being told at the same time as Joseph's story is unfolding. So we have to first tell Judah's story, and then we'll tell Joseph's story. So they're at the same time. So when we get to Joseph next week, it will be at the same time here. It covers the same period of time that Joseph is in Egypt and all the things that are happening to Joseph. It's about 20 plus years that chapter 38 covers. So it's a big time of coverage and very small times. So what we're encountering then is a succinct picture of Judah's life and his character, its disordered focus, and how God is going to work to order it. In Jacob's story, we had the family being exposed to internal strife, right, between the brothers. Here, what we will have in Judah's story is the family being exposed to external strife, strife from the Canaanite culture. And so we look at Judah's character. Of course, we've already gotten some insight into Judah's character in chapter 37. So we'll first look at that really quick, and then we'll go into chapter 38. So what we notice from Judah is that he kind of emerges as the family leader, right? In that where they were trying to dispose of Joseph, despite the fact that there are three brothers that are older than Judah. So let's think through the brothers. We have Reuben is brother number one. Then we have Simeon and then Levi. So those are the first three. But they've disqualified themselves, right? And so, but even though, now, of course, when you're living in the family, you don't really know that they've disqualified themselves. They're, you know, there's still this, are we going to go by the primogeniture ideas or not? But those are the first three. So Judah's number four. So despite the fact that there are three older brothers, it is Judah whom all the other brothers seem to follow. They take his advice. They listen to his plan. So something in Judah is able to lead them and to instill confidence that he has the ability to lead them to good decisions or to a good place, or at least to a place that they want to go to. And of course, that place happens to be a place of gain for themselves, right? That's one of the things that attracts them to Judah, is that he is always looking for how to gain things. What we notice, though, and we notice right away, is that his leadership is disordered. It's a transactional leadership because his advice, first of all, tells us instead of killing, he says, let's trade him for some money. We could actually get something out of this. So immediately you go, okay, that leadership is not actually for the good of others. That's for gain. We also know something else about Judah. We know that he is in line for the birthright because Reuben, Simeon, Levi have all done something so disorderly that it is likely that their father has rejected them as being the ones who will inherit. They are not good leaders for the family. And so because of that, he feels that he is probably in line for the birthright. The problem, Judah knows, is dad has a favorite son, mm-hmm. right? And he's got a favorite son. And so because the primogeniture custom has been so messed up in Jacob's life, because Reuben and Simeon and Levi have been so messed up in their behavior, Judah knows it's very possible that Jacob just throws up his hands and says, forget it, I'm just going to choose the one I love the best to lead this family. I'm not going to just go down the line because it's not working. Because Judah knows that, he knows that if he gets rid of Joseph, it will be to his benefit, right? More than anybody else, to Judah's benefit, it will be to get rid of Joseph. So that means that getting rid of Joseph and the plan that he hatches and tells to his brothers, and he makes it sound like this is a good deal for you, is actually a good deal for Judah. That's the whole idea of this. So his leadership is deceptive. He's pretending as if it's for their good, when in reality, he's understanding, if I get rid of Joseph, I definitely am going to be the one in line for the inheritance, for the birthright. And so we see then a very deceptive leadership. What we'll also see then in chapter 38 is that in attempting to assure his own birthright, he realizes that there's still this idea of sharing, right? So he gets the money. He gets 20 shekels for Joseph. And all of a sudden he realizes he's got to share that. Well, 20 shekels, that's a good, it's almost a year's wage. Oh, that's not bad. But now I've got to share it between really 10 other brothers. Well, that's not very much at all. And then when they bring the information to Jacob and Jacob understands that Joseph has probably died, Jacob gets so distraught, he says, I will never stop mourning Joseph. You've just taken my life, basically, he's saying. And so Judah is getting very impatient. What do you mean you're going to mourn for Joseph your whole life? Does that mean you're never going to appoint an inheritance? Are you going to look at Joseph as the only possibility and that's it? So all of that stirs up the actions of Judah from here on in. So basically the question is Judah giving up on being the leader of the family? Is he giving up because he thinks that Jacob's reaction is kind of told him there's nothing here for you? Yes, so Judah is unwilling to wait to see whether he actually gets that inheritance, which tells us there is no trust of God here. There's no expectancy of good from God here. There's certainly no idea of watching to see how God is going to work this good for the whole family. Because first of all, his whole vision is myopic, right? It's all about, what am I going to get out of this? His plan was all about, what am I going to get out of this? He's going to make it look like it's for something else. But as we know from Judah, especially going forward, Judah is all about Judah. And right now, Judah doesn't see a way forward for him to actually take leadership legally, for Jacob to actually give it over to him. And so the truth, though, about Judah, and this is the truth Judah knows, is that he has a share in the family blessings. He's got a shared wealth, right? Because God has promised to bless them with a land. And that shared wealth should counteract fear, right? Fear of not being able to be provided for, but you're going to have a whole land. He's got a shared picture of relationship to counteract disappointment. Right? You've been promised many descendants. And he has a shared future of vocation, which should counteract anxiety. But notice that all of those things, the blessing of land, the blessing of many descendants, the blessing of a vocation, are all shared. And this is what gets Judah, right? That's the rub. The next action he takes tells us that that is the rub. The world's paradigm is going to interrupt Judah's thinking. It's going to have a voice that says, you can have all of that without needing to share it. You just need to be aggressive and take what you want. An independent paradigm is what is calling him, because that's what the Canaanite society is going to tell him. You can be all about you. You can have this without having to share it. And that's the whole essence here that we're needing to see, is the blessing is of a shared blessing. But Judah doesn't want a shared blessing. Judah wants his own blessing. He wants his, which is really what we've seen throughout, right? We've seen Jacob want that. I want my blessing. I don't want the family blessing. The problem with an independent paradigm is that it will always necessarily be working within a scarcity framework. Because we are finite, embodied, restricted beings. I cannot possibly supply all I need. I'm finite. I have one body. I can't be in many places. I can't do as many things as I need to do to get everything I want. So we need to understand that when we move toward an independent paradigm, a paradigm that says, I can decide what life is all about for myself, I can get what I need for myself, we're always going to be bringing in that, a scarcity mindset. So when we talk about a scarcity mindset, which we've talked many times about, we have to remember a couple things. A scarcity mindset sees the circumstances of life as limitations rather than opportunities. So I see circumstances and I only see the limitations of those circumstances rather than the opportunities. A scarcity mindset believes in a zero-sum world. In other words, if one person wins, somebody else has to lose. So it's a very closed idea. There's only a certain amount of things. There's only a certain amount of opportunities. It focuses then on what you don't have rather than gratitude on what you do have. It's a glass half empty. That's a scarcity mindset. It has a narrow focus about what is possible rather than an expanded awareness of what is possible. So a scarcity mindset always goes along with an independent paradigm. So when we are drawn to an independent paradigm and have this scarcity mindset, we are first and foremost all about getting for ourselves first, right? Once I have, then I can think about others. Once I assure my piece of the pie, since there's a limited pie, since you have one pie and you need to know, I need some of that pie. Once you get that, then you're okay with giving to others. The problem is, getting enough for ourselves is never ending, because we get it and we realize it will be consumed, right? I made a quiche last night and it's in a pie shape. I should have brought it out. And I look at that and I go, there are 8 pieces. So 2 for Bill, 2 for me. But that means only 4 pieces for tomorrow. Only 2 and 2. I can't share that because I'll eat this and now I only have 7 pieces. And then I eat this and now I only have 6 pieces. Wow. So, right, you have this idea of there's only so much. So I have to get, and when I get, it's never enough because I consume it. And now there's less to get. Any time used for getting for somebody else is time taken away from me, right? Because everything I think about is confined to only a certain amount. So a scarcity mindset always, of course, comes from wrong thinking about God, right? Because what we say with a scarcity mindset is, God only has given us so much. He's only given us one pie. And all of us have to share in that, which is exactly what Judah's doing, right? We have one family. We all have to share in that. I need mine, and I'm never going to get enough, right? The inheritance would have been always, gotten double portion from anybody else. But that's not enough for Judah. He wants more. So self-giving and abundancy is not the picture of a scarcity mindset, which means you're thinking about God completely in false ways. Because God is, from Genesis 2, self-giving in abundance. He abundantly gives, and there's never an end of him. God never ends, so he's always able to give over and over and abundantly. So that's kind of where we have Judah being as we enter into chapter 38. And so we need to look at Judah, the work that that God is going to need to do in Judah. And if you notice, and chapter 38 is literally written so that you understand that there are three sections. And it talks about at this time, after a long time, after 3 months. So we see that we have these three sections so that we see that this long span of time really kind of shows us the progression of Judah, of God's work in Judah. So at that time, in other words, that Joseph is being molded and strengthened by God in Egypt, Judah is now being molded and strengthened by God in Canaan. So although Yahweh is never going to be mentioned in chapter 38, we don't see any mention of God whatsoever, the reader does know to look for God's work, right? His spirit hovering to look for disorder, to expose disorder so that he can devour it and transform it into good order. Because the chapter is a comprehensive telling of Judah's life over the next 20 years, the vocabulary is what helps us to root out, well, what is the basics of what's going on with Judah? And what we find is two big key words. The first is give, but it's actually not give, it's to not give. Not give is 8 times. And then to take is 5 times. So with Judah, what we see is a character that doesn't give. In other words, a stingy character. It is the opposite of generosity. So although we have the generosity up here from Joseph and it was immature, for Judah, we have, I'm not giving at all. I'm not going to give my life. That is Judah. That's what we're going to see with him. Instead, I'm going to take what I want. That is what we'll see from him. It reveals that Judah has this lack of wanting to give himself for others. He would rather take for himself. And because of that, it obscures reality for him. He is not able to see clearly what is going on. When we see Judah leave the covenant family in verse 1, we see him determined to embrace the worldly paradigm of independence. And the whole panoply of disordered emotions from his forefathers, from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, will erupt in him. But we'll see it in reverse order. We'll see first the anxiety of his father Jacob that will lead him to self-reliant schemes. This is kind of just an overview of 38. We'll see the disappointment of his grandfather Isaac that we'll see in his going towards self-soothing actions. And then we'll see the fear of his great-grandfather, Abraham, in self-protective schemes. So his actions, all of those actions and those emotions, highlight the paradigm of individual autonomy. That's what Judah is all about. I am going to make a life for myself. I'm going to make an inheritance for myself. And it leads him to where the paradigm of independent autonomy always leads anyone who actually succumbs to that, who actually decides to embrace this independence autonomy. Independence autonomy says everyone has the right to decide for themselves what it means to exist. And if that's true, then any connection to others is by autonomous choice. If I'm autonomous, I get to choose what it means to exist, then I get to decide whether I connect with you or not. There's no intrinsic obligation to care for anybody. That's what an independent, autonomous paradigm says, which relegates then the vulnerable, those who are unable to care for themselves and even choose for themselves. It relegates them to being at the mercy of independent choice makers. right? They have to wait until someone chooses to care for them. And if the vulnerable are too inconvenient for autonomous choice makers, then they will embrace legal ways to eradicate them, which is exactly what Judah does. I'm going to look for ways that are legal in my community, legal in my culture, that make me look good. I'm just following the law, to eradicate those that I really don't want to choose to care for, that are vulnerable, that are in my circle. Because this paradigm says, I get to choose whether I care for someone. And that is so pervasive in our culture that we think it's weird when someone says you have an obligation to care for certain people. To us, we go, we don't have obligations at all. We get to choose. Well, that's because we have embraced an individual autonomous paradigm. So, as we get to chapter 38, verse 1, we see that Judah is going to leave his brothers. He is leaving the family. Well, remember what we said? Judah sees, it doesn't look like I'm going to be the inheritor here, or if it is, it's not going to be for a long time. I do not want to wait. I want it now, and I want my future secured. So I am leaving. And so he actually leaves the family. It came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers. This is a weird thing, because the whole idea of God working with them is working with them as a family. But Judah leaves. And in leaving the family, he leaves behind a promise of being a blessing. He leaves behind land. He leaves behind a promise of a given future and a promise of an assigned vocation. All to find his own. And in fact, one of our Joseph songs actually says something like that. One of the main songs of that will say, I know that God has a plan for me, a land of my own. Well, that is Judah's whole idea. I want everything of my own. And so it says he goes down. Remember, directions in Genesis are huge. Going down is just like going east. It's an indication of moving away from God, away from covenant family, away from what God has given him. And then it says, to visit a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. The visiting there actually is to turn aside. It's not visiting. He turned aside. So in other words, he left the covenant family in order to go toward a Canaanite. Right? So an Adullamite is just one of the many Canaanites that are all around the land, of course. And so he says he's going to turn aside, turn away from family to turn toward the Canaanite culture. It's a complete distancing of himself from the covenant family and toward a Canaanite society. Remember, Canaanite society is a model of independence. The most basic function of such a society is that that freedom to choose is your highest goal. Freedom to choose what it means to exist is the highest call of an independent paradigm community. So in other words, take what you see. Whatever delights you, take it. It's all there for the taking. And so we see that as he goes to Canaanite, as he decides that he's going to embrace the Canaanite culture, it says that Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went to her. What are the two verbs in that verse? Saw and took. Saw and took. Oh, where have we heard those verbs before? Saw and took. Genesis 3, right? And actually we saw it all through Genesis 1 through 11. I saw and I took. And so he's following this worldly paradigm by turning aside, assimilating into the Canaanite culture. Because the most... the quintessential act of assimilation is to intermarry, right? And he's marrying a Canaanite. I'm going to embrace this culture of independent autonomy. This is what I want. And so he goes and sees and takes. Notice, his wife is never given a name.
Yeah.
She has no name. What is she called?
The daughter of
Shua?
The daughter of Shua. Do you know what Shua means? Wealth. Oh. He's going toward wealth. He doesn't really care about the woman because the woman is not even given a name. He doesn't even consider the woman. She's the daughter of wealth. And this is what he's going toward. And so he sees and takes her with this echo of Genesis 3. And that's why it's so important always to keep in mind the context. We've been reading from Genesis 1 on. We know what this means. It's to remind us that the travel down to Canaan, and by the way, when we're talking down, as much as a literary technique as it is, Jacob is living up high in the, remember where Abraham was? And he's going down the hill to the valley, kind of where Lot was. Mm-hmm. So same kind of idea. The assimilation with the Canaanites is to go outside of the boundaries of the covenant family, right? Because the boundaries of the covenant family say, marry within the Abrahamic line to someone who is outside of the land. Why? Because the people outside of the land, the Aramaeans, their idea was when a woman marries, she comes under the paradigms of the husband's family. But Canaanites do just the opposite. The man gets seduced into the Canaanite culture, which is why they weren't ever supposed to marry Canaanites, to go outside the land to find someone who would come into your family rather than the opposite. So it is an absolutely intentional, I am going to intermarry with the Canaanite, is an intentional assimilation into the Canaanite culture. So we have him marrying a Canaanite, and we have him fathering three Canaanite children. Why are they Canaanite children? Well, because that's what happens in a Canaanite family, right? They're Canaanite children now. They are not sons of Israel. And so we have we have Onan, and we have Shelah. And I won't go into their names. It all has something to do with it. But what we do have is that the last is born in Kezeb, which means false. It is a false reality that Judah is constructing here by his Canaanite wife and now a Canaanite family of three Canaanite sons. And not only is he wanting this Canaanite family, right, this wealthy family, and the sons within this wealthy family will assure his future, because that's what children were all about, ensuring their inheritance. He's going to perpetuate the Canaanite family in the Canaanite culture by getting a Canaanite wife for a son. So we see all these things that in the past, in the patriarchs, Abraham made sure to get an Aramaean wife for Isaac. Isaac sent Jacob to get an Aramaean wife for himself. But now we see Judah doing just the opposite. He's now getting a Canaanite wife for his sons. He wants to perpetuate that independent paradigm of get life for yourself, I can establish my own stuff. It's not about connection with others. And so, of course, we have him getting Tamar for his first son, and then, of course, having to give her to his second son. What he's doing is he's ensuring his and his son's future in the Canaanite society, right? You're intermarried, but now that you have children and you're getting Canaanite wives for them, you are totally saying, I'm a Canaanite. I want to be a Canaanite. So this is a big deal for Judah to do this. And for Israel reading this, they're just like, what are you doing here? And so we have then, of course, the first indication that his son Ur is wicked and God kills him. We're not given a reason why, exactly what the wickedness is, but here's what we know about wickedness. Wickedness, evil, is a movement away from a relationship, right? Away from connection with God and with others. So the whole thing is all about relationship. It's movement away. I'm not going to give myself to. That's all we know about Ur. Then we get to Onan, which is the part that I think sometimes we're like, what in the world? It's so weird. We get to Onan. Now, since Ur was the firstborn, right? So we have, remember, Judah and unnamed daughter of Shua. They have three children, Onan, and Shelah. Is the firstborn. He's got the birthright. He dies because he's wicked. So the birthright goes to Onan. So he has the birthright. Unless Ur has a son. Because if Ur has a son, that birthright goes to the son of Ur. But Onan is told by his father, you're going to marry your brother's wife, because there were no children, and in that marriage your first son will actually be Ur's son. That's just law. It's not just Israelite law later, it is the law of the land everywhere. In any culture, that's what happened. The oldest son doesn't have one, the next son marries, and the first son belongs to Ur. So for Onan, what's he doing? He's looking, going, wait a second. If I marry Tamar and I have a son by her, what do I get out of it? I lose my inheritance. I lose being the birthright son. You see that?
Yeah.
So in order to preserve his own inheritance, he disposes of his competition.
I got it.
That's what he does, right? Mm-hmm. So when it says that he dumps his semen, what he is doing is disposing of his competition. Just like his father Judah had done with Joseph. Yeah. Like his grandfather had done with Esau. So the dismantling of this disordered character family trait is continuing, right? And God is needing to really ream this out of the family. So the dumping of Onan's semen is a very vivid picture, right? I can tell you that Bill was like, wow, this is weird. Why am I reading about this? And I told him, anytime we have a picture in scripture that is so like, oh, do we really need to know? It's actually going, I want you to know in your face what this is.
I was wondering why Onan was so, like, your brother's dead. Why do you care, you know?
Yes, and this is why, right? Okay. Because that's not going to be his son. It's going to be Ur's son, and he will get the birthright, this son. So when he dumps his semen, first of all, you should recognize that within the semen, and I like the biblical word, usually calls it seed, which is exactly what it is, right? Mm-hmm. There are between 80 to 300 million seeds in one ejaculation. Think of how many seeds he disposed of in order to get rid of his competition. And how many does he have altogether? Well, they think that there are over 500 billion seeds in a man. Wow. 500 billion. And Onan is going, no, you can't have this. I need to keep this for myself. That's what Onan is doing here. So the picture of this dumping of the seed is supposed to be vivid. You're supposed to go, whoa, that's how much you want to keep. You have so much, and you can't possibly give any to someone who needs. No, I'm going to keep it all for myself. It is the ugliness of stinginess. That's the picture that we're getting here. Access to millions and millions of seed, but he's unwilling to give any because of the fear of losing himself. There's only so many. And in their world, they didn't even know there was a number, billion. So to think of that is like, I have infinite amount, but I just want to keep it all. So because of his wickedness, his evil, his refusal to give his dead brother an heir, he is killed. Mm-hmm. So again, we have this upside down generosity. I'm not giving anything of myself because I don't want to lose anything for myself. And so he refuses to give to Tamar and to his dead brother, and yet he takes Tamar for sex. He treats her like a prostitute. Oh, you will notice this is going all the way back from when the fathers accused Jacob. Do you want our sister to be treated like a prostitute? And now we have Onan treating his wife like a prostitute. I will have sex with you so I can enjoy myself, but I am not giving you anything of myself. And so we have here, Judah, leaving his family, seeing and taking, and then we have complete inability to see into his family. He has a lack of insight as he looks into his family, complete refusal to give to his family at all. So we know that he has anxiety over the future, because he says there's a possibility of him losing his third son. He's invested himself in a cultural paradigm of independence. So, of course, he thinks he must do something about that, right? I have to ensure the last vestige of hope I have for my future. Remember, children are future for them. Children are tell about the inheritance. He completely misses the fact that he has left a very specified future as part of the covenant family. He was given a share of a future in the covenant family, but he walked away from that. And now he's trying to take his own. I'm going to make my own future, my own independent thing. He refuses to give any attention to God's work here. The pronouncement against his sons, when his first two sons die, should be the first sign of recognition for Judah that his own miserly stinginess has actually been affecting others. But he refuses to entertain that possibility. And so he doesn't equate the son's death with God's work. He doesn't say, oh, they must have died because they have acquired this paradigm of keeping life for themselves. And where would they have gotten that? Oh, for me. No, I don't want to entertain that idea. So he's perpetuating the false realities, and he's going to refuse to give to his daughter-in-law at all, right? So he has a disordered shame response to the deaths of his two sons.
I thought he was blaming Tamar.
He is blaming Tamar.
Oh, okay.
And that's his disordered shame response, right? Wait, it can't be possibly me.
Yeah.
I don't want to even think about that. No, it's got to be Tamar. And so, remember, a disordered shame response always moves away from relationship. And usually, the first thing you do when you move away from relationship, you judge and blame, which is exactly what he does, right? So he doesn't want to look at the possibility of him, maybe his paradigm is off, that he hasn't been training his sons to be vocational blessing bearers, because he's already left that. And the culture is ready to supply him with a rationale to move away. And this is key, because sometimes we think we move independently, but we always move within our culture. And if we have embraced that culture, we are going to look for what that culture is going to give us to say, yeah, keep moving away from relationship. And so in the culture, women who seemed very prone to widowhood would have been suspected of witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And so culture says, yeah, Judah, move away. She's probably a witch. Move away. Because labeling others as enemies is our most common rationalization for not giving to someone. Let me say that again, because this is key. Labeling someone as an enemy is the most common rationalization for not giving to them. As soon as we can say they're an enemy, oh, good, I don't have any obligation to give to them. Of course, Jesus is really going to flip that over, isn't he? So he blames Tamar. He says, Tamar, go live as a widow in your father's house. So we need to pull that apart a little bit. Go live as a widow. By any law, widows were declared free to marry if the brother-in-law refuses to marry and seed her, right? So in any law, she could have gone and married. She could have been free to marry. In the Canaanite culture, that would have been fine. But Judah retains his authority over her. He says, go live as a widow in your father's house, retaining his authority over her. So this is so messed up. When he says go back to her father's house, he's refusing to care for her.
Yeah.
He's saying, go let your dad take care of you. And with this pronouncement, when he says, go live in your father's house as a widow until such a time, right? What he's doing to her is trapping her. She now must stay unmarried and chaste on pain of death. Because he is going to engage her to Shelah. So he retains control over her, but he gives her no care, and he actually puts her care back on her father. Now her father must support her. A refusal of care gets shifted to someone else. Always, if I refuse to care for someone, someone else has to do the caring. It doesn't go away. Someone's need doesn't go away because I decide not to care for her. This would have been a breach of contract had it not been for the promise of a future marriage. But Judah decides, I'm going to deny Tamar care right now, but I will cover that by the premise of, well, you can marry Shelah when he's old enough. What he does here, his stinginess denies Tamar, first of all, of well-being. When he sends her to her father's house, her father would not be very happy to have to take care of her again. In fact, in many cultures, he wouldn't do it. He also denies her status in the community. She is no one now. She is a widow who's been taken out of her husband's house, sent back to her father. She is like nothing. So that Judah's refusal to be generous with her, to care for her, to give of himself to her, actually completely denies Tamar of any honor, any dignity, any right well-being. She probably is not treated well in her father's house when she goes back. So we have here a disordered shame, blaming Tamar, and then denying care of her. Because she's an enemy, right? He's labeled her as such. And then we have the deceptive promise. All to elevate himself, right? To make him look good. He basically says to her, just wait. Just wait. Well, isn't that ironic? Because why did Judah leave? Because he didn't want to wait.
Exactly.
But now he tells Tamar, just wait. There'll come a time when she will be old enough and I will let you marry him. And yet, it's a deceptive promise, right? We know here from the text that his scheme is to protect his future. I'm going to refuse to give my son to Tamar, but I'll pretend that I'll eventually do so. But I have no intention of ever doing that. That kind of covers both bases, right? I look good. I have a promise of going to do it eventually, but I never have to ever take care of Tamar. And I never have to put my future at risk, because who knows what will happen to my third son with this Tamar. Plans of deception always assume my own superiority and the other's inferiority. They can't figure out what's going on, right? I'm so superior. I've got these, right? They're not going to, because they're inferior to me. Anytime I'm trying to deceive someone, it always an assumption of, you're not as smart as I am. I can pull the wool over your eyes. When in fact, his own sight is the one that's being obscured. And so we get to verse 12 finally, and we now are going to be looking for God's windy work. But before that, I just want to encapsulate so we understand the immensity of what it is to be stingy as opposed to generous, right? So that's what we're talking about, that Judah is stingy. So it is as if, I didn't want to make these into seed, but some kind of.
Sure. Oh my goodness.
It's as if we have all of this. And Cindy, put out your hand so that the camera can actually see your hand, as if you need something. So Cindy's needy, and she asks, can I have something? And I'm like, I have a limited amount. Well, I'll give you this. Go away, and maybe I'll give you more later. So go away. That's the idea, right? Go away, I'll give you something later. That's all she gets. In reality, generosity says, there is a complete, I have so much, so this is what God is pouring. He wants to say, have whatever you need. Oh, yes, whatever you need, whatever you can hold, even more. That's the idea, right? Of generosity versus this, I like that one. I'll give you this little piece here. That's the idea that we're supposed to be seeing in the story of Judah, right? This idea of stinginess rather than generosity. And what he had back in his family was a generosity. God had promised him, you're going to have all of this land. You're going to have how many descendants? More than you can count. You can give. So, God has a lot of work to do. Here's his windy work. So we have Judah. We're going to follow him. And he's going to, in verse 12 and on, he's going to be looking for some kind of distraction from his disappointment, right? He's going to be looking for soothing. So we know he has disappointment because his wife has died, which means he can have no more sons. Yep. And now he had three sons, and now he only got one left. This is certainly not the picture that he planned when he came down to Canaan, right? The more sons, the better. And three sons, three Canaanite sons under a wealthy family. Ooh, this is going to be great. And all of a sudden, he's left with one. So we know he's disappointed. So that when we know that he goes up to Timnah, he's looking for soothing here. It does say he's done with mourning. Okay, mourning time is done. I'm going to go up and what we'll notice is he's going to go up and have fun. But the fun is really for his soothing. So up to Timnah, first thing we need to go. Oh, we have another directional thing here. Yeah. Up. Well, that sounds really weird because we know what happens here. How can that possibly be up? What the author is trying to do here is to alert us to the fact that although he's going up, he's not going back to his family. And in fact, he's going to soothe himself. The alert is not where Judah intends to go, it is where God intends to bring him through whatever disordered choices he makes. So this is the first indication. The reader should go, oh, wait, God's working here. No matter how disordered Judah gets, God is going to bring him up. So that's the idea of up. We could go through many, many things as we think about Timnah. The first thing I think of Timnah is Samson. It's where he goes to get his Canaanite wife. So it's a very interesting, many different things we could do. So because of his disappointment, he's going up to Timnah. And he's going up for the sheep shearing. Now, sheep shearing would have been a festival. You wouldn't just, it's not just work. It is work with complete party atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It is a celebration. It is absolutely a huge celebration. So his mourning is done, and now he's going up, moving on to partying. This is his soothing scheme, right? It's a lot of people's soothing scheme. Let me go party when I'm not feeling great. And who does he do it with? Ah, that same Canaanite friend, right? The Hiram the Adullamite. Hiram basically means noble family. So once again, he is globbing himself onto what he wants, a noble family, a wealthy family, both by marriage and then by friendship. And we keep seeing this Canaanite friend come up over and over again. Judah never once mentions his brothers.
Yeah.
But man, this friend, this is who he has been holding on to. This noble Canaanite, this friend that's from a noble family, in other words, a wealthy family, a highly respected family in the Canaanite culture. So we know this is his greatest connection, his greatest attachment, right? Because we see him all throughout the story. But as the reader's going through, all we can say is, Judah, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're attaching yourself to the Canaanite paradigm, Canaanite people, and you're completely forgetting your family. But the reader knows God's doing something here because he's bringing him up. How's he bringing him up? Wow, well, let's see. So we have then Tamar. And what we see is, regardless of the fact that Judah can't see what's going on, Tamar can. She sees the truth of Judah's character. She understands that he has a lack of generosity. Well, how does she know that? Because she's the brunt of it, right? I'm the brunt of your lack of generosity, your unwillingness to give to yourself. Because of the length of time, she understands that Judah has no intention of ever marrying her to Shiloh. So not only does he not give, and he takes away my dignity, he takes away my well-being, he takes away my honor, but he never intends to give it back to me. He also knows that Judah is embracing a Canaanite paradigm. She knows this because of what he's already done, that his best friend is a Canaanite, that he has really, he is married into, he's made his sons into Canaanites. She understands that, and somehow she understands that Judah would be free to engage in the cultural practice of prostitution. Prostitution was a normal thing in the Canaanite culture. It wasn't considered immoral. It was part of the culture. It was a transactional culture, right? So it's a transactional paradigm is very up there. Interesting that I'm hearing many calls for legalizing prostitution in America. So you, if you read enough, you'll see that happening. Well, I'm not, you shouldn't be surprised. You shouldn't be surprised at any of these things because we are totally a transactional, independent, autonomous culture. And so to employ the ruse that she does, she has to have some confidence that Judah is not averse to visiting a prostitute, right? So she knows that. So we already know Tamar has a lot of insight into Judah, what he's like. She's veiled. So here are the possibilities. Now, theologians don't all agree on this, but enough of them do that I'm pretty confident that this is what's going on. She is disguising herself as a temple prostitute. Only temple prostitutes were veiled. Regular prostitutes were not veiled. Regular prostitutes, if they were caught veiled, they would be killed. So lots of risk to being a veiled prostitute when you're not a temple prostitute. The fertility cults for the Canaanites would have supplied temple prostitutes along the sides of the roads during the festivals of sheep shearing and planting. The purpose was to appease the gods of fertility as they're going toward wanting fertility for their own crops and or sheep, to assure abundance. So again, trying to assure abundance by a transaction. The veil sought to honor the gods by symbolically reenacting the deity's marriages. So it's like they're reenacting the weddings. They're trying to honor the gods of fertility by reenacting their weddings. That's why a temple prostitute would have been veiled during this time. So they would have been out on the roads for the convenience of the revelers. So all the roads going toward the sheep shearing, which of course is up because it's in the mountain area, and toward the ones who are going to the crops. They would have been there so that they could achieve the most fertility by appeasing the gods. Does that make sense? That's their worship. If this is true, if she is being disguised as a temple prostitute, it also says something about Judah. It says that his assimilation into Canaanite culture is not simply social behavior. It's not simply being willing to visit a prostitute. It's being willing to visit a temple prostitute, which means he has taken in pagan thinking. There are other gods who are in control of fertility, and I'm going to do that. Oh. What has Judah done in walking away from the covenant family? He's so completely immersing himself in the culture of Canaan that he actually visits a temple prostitute. So Tamar is, she sees the truth of Judah. What she wants to do is fight to expose the truth. She is fighting for her life here. So she sits at the gate of Enaim. Enaim means eye opener. Here's reality, Judah. Here's what you've been doing. This will be the event that will lead Judah finally to be able to see the reality of his own stinginess. Even the New Testament tells us, if you're looking back, that anyone who is not willing to care for his relative, and particularly his close relatives, is worse than an unbeliever and denying the faith. Yeah, we don't talk about that very much, do we?
Nope.
And when, remember, every time we're trying to bridge the contexts and bridge it to our own, when we're talking about family, we're talking about the church. We're talking about when Judah looks at Tamar, it is in his own family, assigning guilt, assigning blame, looking at her as an enemy. She is part of the family. When we're always trying to bring that over, we have to think about our own self, yes, within our physical family, but more importantly, and Jesus will reiterate this, the family of the church. So we'll talk about that as we get to the end. So Tamar is fighting to expose the truth. She sits at the gates of Enam, and then she deceives with her clothing. Wow, this is kind of familiar, right? First of all, she takes off her widow's clothing. Tells us a little bit something about Tamar. She is still mourning her last husband's death. But who was her last husband? The one who was like, I'm not giving you any, right? I'm not giving you any. Who shamed her. She's still mourning his death. She is still in widow's clothing. While Judah, who has lost wife and two sons, he's done mourning and he's ready to party. What we're supposed to see is the contrast, and the contrast and the unusual ones, right? It's Judah who's supposed to be the one who looks different, and not Tamar the Canaanite, but we have the things reversed. So she disguises herself with a veil to circumvent the miserliness of Judah, who would not honor her as the widow of her son, nor honor her as the fiancé of her other son. He does this out of self-focus, right? Anxiety over his future. He doesn't want to lose anymore. He doesn't want to be disappointed anymore. But she did think it likely, although he won't honor her as a widow or as a fiancé, he might honor her as a prostitute.
Really?
But Tamar knows Judah, right? And we see that Tamar's right. He is willing to honor the prostitute while not honoring his daughter-in-law. And so, she, of course, we'll get to that in a minute, the exchange with Judah. So the exchange happens, and after the exchange, she returns to wearing her widow's clothing. Her identity deception was never intended to be permanent. She had fully embraced her position as part of an Israelite family. The widow's clothing says that, because as a Canaanite, she would have been free to marry, except that Judah has bound her, right? But she is willing to stay there. And that's really weird in a Canaanite family. What she's trying to fight to say is, see me as part of you. I am in your family. I belong to you. See me. That's the whole idea of sitting in the gate of Enam. See me. I am your family. And so now we look at Judah's blindness. His lack of sight obscures the reality. And of course leads him to disordered decisions. So he sees Tamar as a prostitute. He doesn't realize she's his daughter-in-law. Well, why? Well, first of all, when we're in an independent paradigm, we see what we want to see. Something for our own satisfaction, right? I'm looking for something that will satisfy me. Oh, there's a prostitute. That's all I see, because it's what I want. And if I'm in an independent idea, if I am not under God, waiting for God's expectancy of good, I'm looking for what will satisfy me. And I don't see what I don't want to see, an obligation to care for another. So yes, he completely misses who Tamar is. And it's what the Canaanite paradigm celebrates. Freedom of choice is the highest value. What this does is it highlights the danger of intermarriage with a culture that sees prostitution, the ultimate transactional relationship, as valued, even sacred. And so when we look at that, when we see a culture that values transactional relationships, that should be a warning. That is something that we cannot bring into our lives. Every one of these things that we learn here, we could go to the New Testament and go, oh, this is why Paul was able to say this. This is why Paul says this. So to be able to bring the New Testament back to the Old helps us to see what's going on, right? So he doesn't plan to visit a prostitute. He didn't start out going, I'm going to look for a prostitute. But he's looking for soothing, right? He has no payment with him, so we know he wasn't looking for a prostitute. Right?
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
So we know that.
He has no cash.
Yeah, he has no cash with him. But he's allowing his emotions and his body to lead him away from God's order. This would not have been in the order of family of Jacob, which again reveals his lack of trust of God, his lack of expectancy of good from God, or his dependency on God. He doesn't intend to commit incest. That's not his intention.
Right.
But it all happens because he's letting his body rule him, right? He's letting his emotions move him away from rather than moving toward God. And so what he does, he sees Tamar as a prostitute. He decides to engage her. And he, it's really a funny story because he pledges his honesty. Look, what will you pay me? I'll pay you a goat for sex. But you don't have a goat with you. Oh, but I'm honest and I'll show you how, right? So first of all, the fact that he pays with a goat to someone who is deceiving with clothing, oh, we've got an echo of deception again, right? Oh yeah, clothes and a goat again. We had clothes and a goat with Jacob and Isaac. We had clothes and a goat with Laban and Jacob. We had clothes and a goat with the brothers and Jacob. It continues on.
There's a pattern.
There's a pattern. So Judah's willingness to give is only when he gets something for it, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to give a goat in exchange for something to satisfy himself. He only understands giving as a transaction. But that's exposed here. Judah doesn't even know how or what to give. He wants this prostitute. I want sex from you. I'll give you a goat. Well, how are you going to ensure that? I don't know. I mean, here's this man, and the prostitute has to tell him, well, here's what you can give me to ensure that you're going to give that payment back. And so she takes the lead, and she tells him how to validate his promise. She names the most valuable thing he has, and that is his identity. So she asks for his seal, his cord, and his staff. His seal. So the seal would have been, it would have been a small cylinder, kind of like one of those candles here. It would have been a small cylinder, but it would have had moldings on it. So that as you took that and you rolled it across soft clay, it would make an impression, right? And the molding in there would have been unique to Judah. It would have been his signature.
They have a lot of those at the Oriental Museum in Chicago.
I know. I thought about that.
It's a great place to go to get looks at these old cultures of the Bible.
Yes. I took the class there once. Not many people thought it was very interesting, but I loved it. Someday we'll go back there again. So it's this cylinder, which has his unique inscription on it, basically, that can roll into soft things. It would be like our credit card. In fact, when all the electronic stuff goes down in a store and they want your credit card, what do they actually do? They roll a pencil over it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Piece of paper, roll a pencil over it. Oh, yeah.
Not anymore. The new ones aren't
great.
And gift shoes now.
Yeah. So, yes. So, that's the seal. It was used for transactions and correspondence. It was your signature. The cord is what the seal was hung by around your neck. So you wore it, just like you wear your credit card right in your purse, right? Mm-hmm. Right in your wallet. You just carry that with you. And it was hung around the neck, so it was easily accessible because it was the way that you made payment for anything. The staff would have been a walking stick, and on top there would have been an insignia of your authority within your family. So the insignia would have been a clan insignia, a family insignia. So what she's asking for is his identity of both his individuality and his family. Both of those identities need to be transformed here. We cannot misuse our individual identity without damaging our family identity.
Yep.
So Tamar knows what to ask for, and he's willing to give it. He gives his whole identity away. It would be like us giving our credit card to someone, along with our address, because now that you have to have the zip code, our address and, oh, our Social Security, here you go. You have it all. He's willing. This is how much he doesn't even understand transactions. I'm going to give you the most important thing for who I am, in exchange for what I want right now.
Sounds like selling your birthright for a pot of
salt. It does, doesn't it? Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so, obviously, they don't talk about the event. They obviously have the event, the intercourse. And then afterwards, he's looking to pay his debt. And we think, oh, what an upstanding citizen. He wants to pay his debt. It's pretty ironic, though, that he's willing to pay the debt that he has to the prostitute, but not the debt to his daughter-in-law.
Somebody wants the ID stuff back.
Yes, right? So, and that was the reason that she asked for it, right? It's going to be needed quickly, mm-hmm. and so he's going to ask for it back. So he has his friend do it. One of the reasons is, right now, we have a fear of humility. Right, of humiliation, which is what we saw with Sarah. So we're all the way back to Abraham's, oh, now he has this fear of humiliation. I don't want to be humiliated. So once again, I'll send my friend. Mm-hmm. The friend is, of course, his greatest attachment. His friend is again going to be the go-between for a transaction, which is what Hiram has always been. He's always been the go-between for a transaction. Go bring the goat and get my stuff. He makes a public search, right? He asks the men of the place, where's the temple prostitute that sat at the gate at 10 a.m.? Doing so would easily hide the real task and the real identity of Judah, right? And here's why. Hiram is a Canaanite. It would have been very normal for the Canaanite to go looking down the road during sheep shearing time for a temple prostitute. No big deal. Everybody's doing it. It would... he's just looking for to do his pay his worship, right? That's all he's doing. The failure to find the prostitute means the task of paying his debt would now expose Judah if they keep looking. Because now it's not just, oh, I'm just looking for a prostitute to pay my worship respects. It's, I'm looking for a specific prostitute so that I can pay her because... the deed was already done by mm-hmm. someone else.
Was that the humiliation part, that he didn't have the money with the men? He had to go on credit?
So the humiliation part is to be found out because he's not a Canaanite.
Oh, okay.
To be found out that he is actually engaged in this. Here's the deal. As a Canaanite, it's no big deal for Hiram to be doing this, right? To be looking for a prostitute. Because what he's looking for is the Cain of Judah, it carries a reminder that, oh, he's not a Canaanite. He actually belonged to the family of Jacob. And you want to ask, well, will the Canaanites care? I don't know that they would care. Who's he really protecting from? Himself. Because he knows I'm supposed to be a member of the covenant family who's supposed to show the world a different way of being human. And if I am the one to claim, oh, here's my stick, here's I've been doing the Canaanite way of life, it exposes himself to himself. That's what he's doing. He's have you not ever done that? To kind of, I don't really want to look at what I've been doing, so I'll make sure something else happens. I've had several people say, well, I don't want to do that, but I'll have my husband do that. Because you don't want to be seen as doing something that you think is maybe shady, or what's the deal? That's what's going on with Judah here. And of course, Hiram can't find the girl, and now he's going, well, I can't be exposed, so let's just forget about it. We're not going to make the payment. And he rationalizes, which is what we've many times done ourselves, right? I tried to pay, and I couldn't. Really, he's saying, I tried up until the point where it was going to cost me something. Mm-hmm. And once it's going to cost me something, well, no, I tried. Again, notice how many masks Judah keeps putting on. Pretending that he is an honorable person. No, he doesn't want to be found out, mainly to himself. And so, where's God been working here? Where's the windy work that the author isn't bringing out? Well, first of all, with the up, right, that he's going up to Timnah, that he would encounter Tamar at just the right time, just the right place, particularly when we find out there are temple prostitutes in that place. and that Judah would hire her and not see her as Tamar.
Yeah.
It's like the one guy that Joseph runs into. Where's my brothers?
Yes, exactly. It's the whole, oh, this is where God's working. And that one encounter actually impregnates Tamar. Mm-hmm. Like one encounter and that's it? That's all it takes? Oh, yeah, but God's working behind the scenes here. We know that. And so we get then to 24 and the end of the idea. So 3 months later, here's the next section. And now we have God's incorporating work. Remember, God's winning work is what we don't see. But then God's incorporating work is him taking the disorder, devouring it, and transforming it. And this is what he does. So we have the public exposure. Of course, Judah thinks the public exposure is for Tamar, right? So Tamar has played the harlot, he finds out, and she's with child. So Judah's response is,
burn her!
Let her be burned, bring her out, expose her, show everyone who she is. What's he doing? He's celebrating the legal right to get rid of her. He's embracing, yes, see, she was in my way. She was going to make it harder for me to get my inheritance, harder for me to have, you know, the career I thought I'd have and the job I thought I'd have. She's going to make it hard, but here's a legal right. She is not good. See, she's a harlot. Yay, let's celebrate this. Judah still has jurisdiction over her. The offense, by the way, is not the harlotry. Remember, prostitution is legal.
Right.
Where's the offense?
She pretended to be a temple prophet. They broke the marriage covenant?
Yeah. What marriage covenant?
She wasn't chaste.
She wasn't chaste because who was she engaged to?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the problem. It's adultery. Oh. Adultery is completely, remember we talked about this all the way in Abraham's story. Adultery was the highest form of social unrest. You ruined the idea of the family, adultery. That's what's going on here. He's saying that she is an adulterer. He's concerned for his reputation. And grace and mercy are not a prized value in Canaan, just as they weren't in Rome. They would have looked at him as weak. And I'm concerned about my reputation. And hey, I get to embrace this legal means of getting rid of what could have really ruined my reputation.
Which is
sounds great.
Like, he'll pick up the Israelite, you know, concept of marriage and marriage covenant when it's convenient. But was it the same with the Canaanite? Like, it was still a marriage?
Yes.
If somebody broke, it was life-threatening?
Yes. Okay. Yep. So this is a whole A&E thing. Yep, they all would have agreed. They would have all seen her as a harlot because she was adulterous. I took that off. Can you press the red button? So, we have Tamar playing the harlot, but in reality, the exposure is Judah playing the stingy miser. And Judah confesses. The first thing he says is, Tamar is righteous. So, we need to parse that out a bit, because I know when you're reading it, the first time you're going, how is she considered righteous? Let's think about this. She was the one who did justice to the relationship. By Levirate law, a male relative can become the surrogate merely for the purpose of marrying a child. Once the child is born, any sex would have been incest. Levirate law doesn't specifically mention a father-in-law, but it keeps that open. Yes, the father-in-law could have been the surrogate. So even with Levirate law, Tamar is okay there. She fought to give herself to the covenant family. She was fighting for that, like Jacob, when he prevailed in the struggle in order to hold on to being under the blessing of the covenant. That's what Tamar was doing. I belong to this family. I want to be in this family. I want to be under the blessing of the covenant, and I am going to fight for that. She was willing to risk her life for the sake of identifying with the covenant family. That ruse could have gotten her killed, could have degraded her even worse. She could have been ostracized, left without recourse for a supported life. There was nothing about the Rus that would have helped her in Canaanite culture.
Oh.
It only helped her to say, I am part of the covenant family. I am leaving the Canaanite family. She's rejecting her father's house by seeking to be faithful to Judah's house. This is the opposite and against her cultural paradigm. Tamar's, although for us it looks really weird, she is fighting like Jacob did. I'm fighting to be in this family. I'm fighting. You brought me into this family. Don't keep pushing me out. I want to stay here. I want to be a covenant partner. Her faithfulness to Judah's house, despite the shameful treatment she has gotten from both her husbands and her father-in-law, contrasts to Judah's own faithlessness to his own father's house. Tamar cared more for the integrity of relationships within the covenant family than did Judah. Now, the means to the ends don't justify her actions, but unlike Sarai, who manipulated her own way, right, to get a covenant child, Tamar isn't yet part of the covenant paradigm because the family keeps pushing her out. She's unaware that the actions she takes would not be consistent with Yahweh's ways. Why is she unaware of that? She's a Canaanite. She's living in a covenant family who has not practiced covenant ways, right? She has no way of knowing. Her husbands were both wicked, and her father-in-law is not a model of godly behavior. How else would she wouldn't know? Even the New Testament tells us that although we are to keep one another accountable for our godly behavior within the family of Christ, it is not the same outside the family of Christ. We do not put up the behavioral consistencies within the family of Christ. We don't put that on outside the family of Christ. They can't. They have no ability to do so. That's what's happening here with Tamar. Yes, we can bring her in. She's not doing this out of sin for her. She does not know what she's doing. She's coming in, and what she wants more than anything is to be part of the family of God.
There's probably a little bit of, she's been denied having a child. And I don't know that she loved her husband or not. You know, these arranged marriages, there may not have been any love in it. Mm-hmm. But she was definitely cheated out of being a mother. And so that's probably part of her.
Well, definitely is part of her. But here's the biggest thing about Tamar. She wants a child in the covenant family and not in the Canaanite family. Because what she could have done is she could have asked Judah, release me. I can go and marry a Canaanite and have children. Instead, she fights to stay in the covenant family. And that's the big thing about Tamar, which is why we find her in the genealogies. She fought to be in the covenant family. When Judah pronounces her righteous, he finally gives to her her dignity. He returns her dignity that she took from her, that he took from her in the beginning. Judah upholds her as the model. This will help her assimilate into his family, finally. It will also help her break from Canaanite society. He has now said yes. She is righteous. She belongs in the covenant family. And then he says, I am not righteous. Now, I know most of your translations put it this way. Tamar is more righteous than I. It is not a comparison phrase. It does not say that. It says she is righteous. I am not righteous. There is no hierarchy in righteousness. Right? Do you ever see that anywhere?
You either are or you aren't.
You're either moving toward relationship or you're moving away from a relationship. You're not, oh, I'm moving relationship faster than you are. There's none of that. I am righteous. Tamar is righteous. I am not righteous. Judah acknowledges publicly. Remember, Tamar brings him out publicly. He announces publicly that he's been moving away from relationship. And humility is not a virtue thought well of in the Canaanite society, which would distinguish, finally, Jacob as being different than the Canaanites. This is the first time that Jacob shows a different side of what Judah. Judah. Jacob, Judah, Joseph, gotta keep them straight. He says, I am not righteous because I did not give my son. I did not give. Right there he says, I have been stingy. I have not been a generous daughter keeper. He recognizes that relationship requires generously giving of self with the concern for the other. Not so that you get something back, but that is what relationship is. Giving fully of myself so that the other flourishes. He's learned by the reversal of his own self-seeking schemes the value of being a daughter's keeper. Which begs the question as the reader reads this, I wonder if he will now learn to embrace being a brother's keeper. Right? That the end should go, where is Judah going to go from here? Mm-hmm. And so we have Judah giving. It says he did not have relations with her again. What this implies is that he brought her into his house as to care for her as the mother of his children, but doesn't take advantage of her as if the caring for her entitles him to sex. He's no longer seeing this as a transactional thing. I don't see you as that. And that would have been actually consistent with all A&E law. A&E law would have said a father-in-law can birth the child in those circumstances, but afterward, you're not her husband. The father doesn't ever become the husband, because then it would have been considered incest. So any law, Levirate law, all kind of look at that situation the same way. So what he's doing here is he's giving her honor as his daughter-in-law. In fact, going forward in Israel's history, Tamar is always referred to as Judah's daughter-in-law. Never his wife, always his daughter-in-law. That's why he doesn't sleep with her again. He's respecting her position in the family. He gives her the initial respect that he withdrew from her. And lastly, we have the public exposure, and now we have the public incorporation of God taking what was completely disordered, devouring it, and now turning it into something for their good. So we see God's abundance grace here. God gives the two of them not just a child, two children. Abundance, right? More than enough. Twin children would have been scary, but also absolutely amazing for anybody in the Ainite culture. His generosity then overwhelms the losses for both Judah and Tamar. Judah lost two sons. Mm-hmm. Tamar lost two husbands. Mm-hmm. Now they have two sons. It's not to replace... What?
It's so cool.
It's so cool, right? It's beautiful. Like, I will overwhelm you, giving you what you need. But in the birth of the twins, he gives them a picture, though, to remember what has been happening. And he gives them a picture of these two twins. We have Zorah, who first gives out his hand. I'm giving out my life. And then what does he do? Oh, well, there's a picture, Judah. That's who you've been. You've been saying, oh, I'm going to give you my... Nope, got to keep it back. Perez, on the other hand, says, get out of the way. I am going to make myself a space. I'm going to break a breach for me. I'm going to give myself fully, even if that means breaking through the obstacle of self-absorption, which would have been the idea of Zorah, right? I'm going to give you... No, I'm going to keep it for myself. All of the things that happen in this short chapter are beautiful pictures of what it looks like to be stingy and then say, no, forget it. Perez is the picture of what Tamar has been doing. No, I don't care. You get out of my way. I'm going to make myself a breach and I'm going to come out. So we have this picture for both of them. It's not about pretending you're going to give. It is all about, no matter how much it takes, give yourself fully to the world, to your family. And so God makes a breach for both of them, makes a way for both of them. Neither Judah nor Tamar really deserve to have the grace of children. Their deceptive plans are not what brings the births about. Even though when we read it, we go, oh, well, Tamar's plan worked. But when A&Es are reading this, they're going, oh, who brings about birth? God. Or the A&E would have said the gods, right? In fact, the whole premise was the gods are in charge of fertility. That's what Tamar pretended to be, right? They're in charge of fertility. We can't ensure our own fertility, but the gods can. So they would not have said, oh, Tamar's plan worked, Judah's didn't. No, they would have said, oh, God worked. God is the one who made a place for us. God is the one who's being abundantly graceful. They've both been humiliated within the Canaanite paradigm. They now understand that this Canaanite culture is more like a walled place, this place of independence, this place of autonomy, where freedom, we have the freedom to determine your own existence. In reality, that's an isolating paradigm. That is not, we are so concerned about our freedom that we forget that freedom to run anywhere isn't freedom, it's danger. But freedom to run within a boundary place, that's freedom. That will get you there. So, as Perez breaks out to overcome, as with Jacob, who broke out through the wrestling match, and now we have Tamar doing that, and God gives both Tamar and Jacob a place. He invites the straying Jacob back into the covenant family. How do we know that? Because the twins are born with an echo of the twins, Jacob and Esau. Right, that whole idea is, oh, this is covenant family. His treatment of Tamar may not make him very welcome in Canaanite society. That's a good thing. We see Judah seeing God's work finally to bring about what Jacob couldn't do for, or what Judah couldn't do for himself. The twins with the similar birth stories, right? You should see the echo there, right? Because one comes out and they tie a red string on his finger and then he brings it back in, right? Picture of Esau, the red-haired man, who should have come out first, but that Jacob comes out. It affirms that this is the line that will lead the covenant family. Perez will be Jacob. The A&E would have read that easily. It takes us a little minute, like, wait, well, because it's an echo of who we know Jacob was chosen by God to be, right, the family leader.
But wasn't Perez the first one out and he would do the same?
No.
And then, ow.
Perez is the one who breaks it. Mm-hmm. The first one out is
the guy
with the hand, right? He takes his hand out and then he pulls it back. That's the one who has the red thread. Yes?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Even though Perez actually comes out.
Perez finally comes out, but in reality, the first one out into the air was the hand, right? And that was
Zerah. That's why the red string.
That's why the red string.
Because after his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Do you get what's happening?
I'll have to walk through that after the recording.
Okay. We'll talk about that in the discussion. So because of the echo of Jacob and Esau's, we understand that God is saying, this is the covenant line. This is the line that will lead the whole family. This is Perez will lead that whole family. So Perez takes the place of Jacob, and we see that. And so what we understand here is that, oh, Judah is going to be the leader. Because he's, right, the line that Perez comes from. It speaks directly to what Judah had gotten fed up with and walked away from. I'm not going to be the leader. And God says, I'm going to make you the leader. I'm going to make you the leader. Not you. I'm going to make you the leader. This is the abundant grace that he has for Judah. He also has abundant grace for Tamar as he invites the stranger in, right? He doesn't only invite the straying Jacob or Judah in, but now he invites the stranger Tamar into the covenant family. Because the twins are both affirmed as covenant boys, it says that Tamar is now irrevocably included into the covenant family. And of course, we know further into Israel's history, we understand that it's from Perez's line that comes King David. And that Tamar is the first of three pagan women who are in the line of David. And of course, four women in the line of Christ. Right? So we know that Tamar becomes the first indication that the generosity of God's grace will extend to will extend its abundance to even the most other, to the Gentiles, to the pagans. Tamar is us, guys, because it foreshadows a Gentile bride in the Messiah's line, and that Gentile bride is us. So thinking over the story of Tamar, how she fights to be in the covenant line, is beautiful. God cares for Tamar, as not only does he bring her into the covenant family, but he assures her of her care for her future, because two sons will assure the caring of a mother all the way into her future. So we have this abundance of grace that God gives both Judah and Tamar, but we also have an abundance of warning here. Judah's story here gives us insight into why God will bring the family into Egypt. First of all, we understand that he's going to need to bring them out of Canaanite influence and temptation to assimilation. We see the danger here, right? Of being in the Canaanite culture and assimilating, right? Because when they assimilate into the Canaanite culture, they take on a lie about who God is, that he is stingy, that he only has so much to give, right? It's all about a transaction. And assimilation into a lie about God threatens their unique character and vocation. We're supposed to tell the world about who God really is. If we assimilate into the culture that says independent autonomy is how life is best lived, God only has so much, we have a scarcity mindset, all of that negates the vocation of telling the truth about who God is. And so God is going to need to take them out of Canaanite civilization for a while and incubate them in a place where temptation to assimilation is non-existent. So yes, they go to another place where the paradigm is completely off, but in Egypt, they will not be tempted to assimilate. And you'll see that as we go on to the story, why they're not tempted. Remember, Romans tells us where sin abounds, grace abounds even more. That's what's happening here. God's grace abounds with generosity over the lack of generosity in Judah, so that Judah is going to be able to lead with abundant generosity as he returns to the covenant community. We have an abundance of shaping going on here for Judah. He's going to be shaped by the loss of his children. He's going to be shaped by humiliation. And he's going to be shaped by God's mercy. So we'll see all of that as God works behind the scenes and incorporating all of these things. And so, in summary, we know that God's work follows us into our strayings. We can walk away from the covenant family, and God is going to follow us. We know that God is not averse to bringing in the object of our disordered loves as a tool for our molding, which means our past disordered choices remain as vital parts of our testimony. There are rough rocks that once were rocks only to have been pressurized into diamonds. Our past is a continual field of gems, not meant to be hidden. I think this is one thing I rarely, if ever, have heard. All of the things in our past where we were disordered, where we were walking away from God, God has used those, and he's transformed those. They are not to be hidden. They are to be brought out and said, this is who I was, and this is what God used to transform me. I remember years ago, I taught priestesses for a long time under Kay Arthur. Went to Israel with Kay, I've eaten lunch, and she told us that She used to all the time. She still does. She will tell her testimony, and she will begin with, "I was." I don't know what words she used, and she uses pretty specific words about her promiscuity. I was completely promiscuous. God uses that. And she was told in many churches that she should not talk about that. Oh. And here's the deal, guys. Those are part of God's work. Mm-hmm. Judah's whole thing, here it is. Forever and ever and ever and ever in his word, we get to see that because it's part of God's work. When we put aside the things that God has done with us, when we put aside those hard, really awful things that we are ashamed of, we shouldn't be ashamed of them. We should be going, look what God has done. God used this to mold me into someone who looks more like him. We should never shame someone who tells their story about what God has done. This is an amazing thing. This is what God intends for us to do. But we do need to face the truth of our own stinginess. Our stinginess to give love, to give honor, to give dignity to our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. Remember, the whole chapter of Genesis is talking about within the family. We're not talking about outside the family. Those for other passages. Here we're talking about how do we treat brothers and sisters in Christ. In effect, when we don't give them love or dignity or honor, we refuse to be brothers' keepers, which puts us in the company of Cain. We murder our own brothers and sisters when we refuse to give them ourselves. We refuse to give them dignity and honor and love. So the exposure of our stinginess, our unwillingness to give ourselves fully to others, helps us see the reality of who we are when we're not connected. It allows us to agree with God that that is not the identity of humanity. That's not who he created humanity to be. And thus it's an invitation to move toward and be molded by God's abundant generosity. And so I want to finish this lesson with, I'm going to pray the prayer that I talked about last week, but I want you first to take a few minutes, put down your notes, close your eyes, and I want you to ask God, where have I been stingy in giving out myself to another within the body of Christ? I want you to ask God if he would reveal a specific person or a specific group of people to you where you've been stingy. And as you think about that, I want to pray this prayer, and I want you to pray it in your hearts with me. This, by the way, is the long version of the song that I have on the website, Audrey Assad's I Shall Not Want. So as she sings, deliver me from these things, it's out of this prayer. So, Jesus, meek and humble of heart, hear me. From the desire of being esteemed, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being loved, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being extolled, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being honored, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being praised, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being preferred to others, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being consulted, deliver me, Jesus. From the desire of being approved, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being humiliated, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being despised, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of suffering rebukes, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being slandered, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being forgotten, deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being ridiculed, deliver me, Jesus. from the fear of being wronged. Deliver me, Jesus. From the fear of being suspected. Deliver me, Jesus. That others may be loved more than I. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be esteemed more than I. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That in the opinion of the world, others may increase and I may decrease. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be chosen and I set aside. Jesus, grant me the desire to desire it. That others may be praised and I unnoticed. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be preferred to me in everything. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may become holier than I, provided that I may become as holy as I should. Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. Amen.